The headlines: Saudi Arabia steps up its airstrikes on Yemen, hitting the capital Sana'a and a northern grains port, which is a UN-brokered neutral zone. Russia's foreign minister says his country and China should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions. And also, severe floods in Australia's most populous state of New South Wales forces the evacuation of nearly 20,000 people. Our top story for this half hour: the Saudi-led coalition waging war on Yemen since 2015 has unleashed dozens of fresh airstrikes against the impoverished nation. The coalition says it has pounded military positions in the capital Sana'a and the port of Salif on the Red Sea coast, but the United Nations says some civilian areas also came under attack. According to the UN, a grains port in Salif, as well as a warehouse and a fruit production company, were targeted. The raids have violated a 2018 agreement brokered by the UN that designates the port of Salif as a neutral zone. Yemen's Ansarullah movement has slammed the attacks, saying that these were part of Saudi Arabia's economic warfare against Yemenis. Saudi Arabia has imposed a sea and air blockade on Yemen, which was badly hampered humanitarian efforts to save civilian lives in Yemen. Activist and political commentator Hossein Al-Bukhaiti says the Saudi raids on Yemen show the kingdom's desperation.
Actually, what is silly from the UN observer who are in Hodeidah at this time, they said there was two strikes, and then they have not actually mentioned or say Saudi or coalition strike. They left it as if something is unknown. Nobody knows where this strike come from, and to show you that the United Nations actually try so hard not to mention Saudi in any of their statement. And yesterday there was about 5 airstrikes on the capital Sana'a. They have targeted the so-called military maintenance. This area, central Sana'a, has been targeted, I think, from the beginning of the war with maybe 80 to 70 airstrikes. And there is nothing in that area, only old truck, old military vehicles, some banned tires at that area. That's why there was a huge fire at that place where the strikes took place. And to be honest with you, that all those strikes actually shows that the Saudi actually has not got anything to bring to the battle, only to target every now and then the capital Sana'a and to keep target and many civilians area.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution has harshly criticized U.S. policies regarding the West Asia region. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said Washington is committing mistakes in the region by supporting Israel and maintaining its usurping presence in Syria. The leader further described the normalization of ties between, quote, insignificant governments with the Israeli regime as worthless, adding that the Islamic community will never forget the issue of Palestine. Ayatollah Khamenei also slammed the U.S.'s support for Saudi Arabia in its years-long assault on Yemen. The leader also said the U.S. is mistaken, rather was mistaken, to hope that by giving Saudi Arabia abundant military equipment, they were able to force Yemen to surrender within days. The leader made the remarks during his annual address on the first day of the Iranian New Year. He also touched upon the 2015 nuclear deal and Washington's unilateral sanctions on Tehran.
The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says if the U.S. practically lifts all sanctions, Iran will return to full compliance with the 2015 nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran began scaling down its JCPOA commitments in May 2019, a year after former U.S. President Donald Trump walked away from the accord. Iran says its measures are in line with two paragraphs of the pact and in response to the failure of the remaining signatories to fulfill their obligations. Iran and the administration of Joe Biden now remain in a standoff over who must take the first step and come back to full compliance with the deal. The multinational accord was signed under former U.S. President Barack Obama. Ayatollah Khamenei says the main problem over the issue is that U.S. promises have no credibility and Iran cannot trust Washington. Ayatollah Khamenei also touched upon the maximum pressure campaign launched by Donald Trump, saying it failed and disgraced the U.S. He warned that Joe Biden's administration will fail as well if it continues that campaign. Ayatollah Khamenei called U.S. sanctions against countries a big crime, as they hinder access to food and medicine. He said in Iran, young people have turned U.S. sanctions into opportunities by producing goods that had to be imported. Some politicians inside the U.S. also agree that the so-called maximum pressure campaign has failed to produce any results. They include incumbent Secretary of State Antony Blinken. Iran has time and again said the ball is now in the U.S. court. Tehran says it's Washington that should decide on whether to go ahead with that failed campaign or change course.
Political analyst Mohammad Marandi says a leader of the Islamic Revolution is reminded the U.S. and its European allies that Iran is growing more and more immune to sanctions.
He was, again, trying to remind his audience, but also remind Western countries that the maximum pressure campaign has failed, and that although Biden so far is continuing Trump's policies, he's trying to remind the Americans and their European allies who've been working with the Americans to implement the maximum pressure campaign and to make women and children suffer as much as possible, he was reminding them that their ability to continue with these sanctions is decreasing. The impact of these sanctions are decreasing as time goes by, because the Iranians have been becoming more self-reliant, they've become more innovative, they're using new technologies to circumvent the sanctions and also to produce a lot of what they needed to import before inside the country. And as time goes on, therefore, the sanctions will lose its impact increasingly. And he was basically saying that this government, and especially the next government, has to be reliant on the nation and on the capabilities of the nation, rather than pinning their hopes on the Americans fulfilling their promises, which they never do.
Israelis revoked the VIP permit of the Palestinian foreign minister after his return from a trip to the Hague-based International Criminal Court, which is probing war crimes against the regime. The revocation of the VIP status means Riyad al-Maliki will need Israel's permission for any future travel abroad. Last week, Maliki met with the ICC's chief prosecutor to demand she speeds up an investigation into Israel's war crimes in the occupied West Bank and the besieged Gaza Strip. He also called on the court to end the era of impunity and start the path of instability for Israel. The investigation is expected to look into the 2014 Israeli war on Gaza, killing of Palestinians along Israeli barriers separating Gaza with the occupied territories, as well as the regime's illegal settlements on Palestinian lands. Israel has fiercely opposed the probe. The polls in Israel suggest rival parties are neck and neck in upcoming general elections, and like previous elections, there will be no clear winner to form a cabinet. Mona Candil has more in this report.
To break a seemingly endless cycle of elections and a political deadlock. However, polls before election day conducted by Israeli channels all suggest continued political deadlock, as none of the Israeli blocs are expected to receive 61 seats in order to form a cabinet, not Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's own Likud party. Pressure has mounted in the election run-up on Netanyahu, who is on trial for corruption and accused by critics of mismanaging the coronavirus pandemic.
As polls show, Netanyahu's Likud party could gain the largest share of the votes. However, it won't be enough to form the cabinet, and this means Netanyahu must again seek to form a coalition. Yet, many in Netanyahu's own right-wing camp and Knesset members say they won't work with him. Many believe the man's becoming a pariah in Israeli politics.
Observers say the greatest challenge to Netanyahu's rule comes from amongst his own ranks in the Israeli right. There is Gideon Sa'ar, leader of the New Hope Party, one of Netanyahu's closest allies in the Likud, and there is also Naftali Bennett, chairman of the Yamina Party, who boasts solid right-wing credentials that make him a popular alternative to Netanyahu.
There is a kind of a big competition between him and Bennett inside the Likud party. And apparently Netanyahu is threatening now to cancel Bennett in a way or another to achieve the elections to be he will be as a prime minister. This is one problem for Netanyahu. The other problem that he's facing is the Israeli people who are getting on Saturdays for now more than 20 times in demonstrations against Netanyahu.
Netanyahu is the Israeli prime minister since 2009, and he's running for re-election while standing trial on corruption charges. And since 2019, neither Netanyahu nor his opponents have been able to win enough seats in the Knesset to form a coalition with a stable majority, and that has left Netanyahu in office despite a clear opposition. So as the latest polls show that neither Israeli bloc has a clear route to a majority, leaving the Israelis bracing for another inconclusive result and a possible fifth election later in the year. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Russia's foreign minister has begun a visit to China to hold talks with his Chinese counterpart on a range of bilateral and international issues. Sergei Lavrov's trip comes amid Beijing and Moscow's heightened tensions with the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden. Both Russia and China are marking the 20th anniversary of their good neighborly and cooperation treaty. Before leaving for Beijing, Lavrov told Chinese media that the two countries should replace the U.S. dollar to protect their economies against Western sanctions.
Everyone knows that the U.S. claims to restrict sci-tech development in Russia and China as a target. Therefore, we should promote the settlement of local currencies and other international currencies that can replace the U.S. dollar by enhancing independent innovation to gradually get rid of the international payment systems controlled by the West and reduce the risk of sanctions. The sanction policies by the West go against the right trend of history, yet the course of history cannot be stopped.
Lavrov added that Western countries, led by the U.S., are trying to maintain their domination over the global economy and international politics at any cost, including through sanctions. His comments come after Washington vowed to take fresh anti-Russia measures over its alleged intervention in the U.S. presidential elections. The U.S. is also locked in a spate of disputes with China, including over Hong Kong, Taiwan, and the South China Sea. A Canadian man has gone on trial in China on espionage charges amid strained relations between Ottawa and Beijing. Michael Kovrig, a former diplomat, has been in custody since December 2019. His hearing in Beijing comes days after a closed-door trial of another Canadian, Michael Spavor. Both were formally charged last June with spying. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau blasted China for holding the trial, quote, in secret. The trials appear to be in retaliation for Canada's arrest of the chief financial officer of Chinese tech company Huawei in 2019 on a U.S. warrant, but China insists the detentions are not linked to the case of Meng Wanzhou, who is under house arrest in Vancouver. Stephen Rivet says there might be a Cold War-type prisoner swap between China and Canada in the future.
I think both of these men will surely be imprisoned. Trials such as these, I think 99% success rate, or they will be convicted as charged. What's interesting to see is if there will be some kind of diplomatic agreement which secures their release, maybe something like a spy swap, as we used to see in the Cold War between the Soviet Union and America. China is in fact giving a warning to Canada, because you must remember that Meng Wanzhou was arrested on the request of America. She was actually in Canada, and I think she still is under house arrest. And China's angle on this is that Canada, if it observes its interests, it should be neutral in the building rivalry between China and the US. And in China's eyes, this is Canada clearly taking sides, clearly doing America's bidding, and getting to an argument, a dispute, a fight, which Canada should not be in.
Days of rainfall is wreaking havoc in Australia's most populous state of New South Wales, with authorities planning to evacuate thousands more people from low-lying Sydney suburbs.
There are around 15,000 people who've been evacuated from the mid-north coast from their homes. In the Nepean Richmond Valley region or Hawkesbury region, there have been about 3,000 evacuations to date. 19 evacuation orders have been issued and potentially more to come.
The government has also declared a natural disaster in large swaths of the state where unrelenting rains have caused widespread damage. On Sunday, authorities issued evacuation orders for the city of Sydney after its largest dam overflowed, inundating a large area. No human casualties have been reported so far. This is the worst flooding for Sydney and other areas along Australia's east coast in 60 years. Weather forecasters warn of more rains over the next few days. In New South Wales, a severe flood warning has also been issued for neighboring Queensland. Thousands of Americans have marched in major cities, including Atlanta, New York, and Washington, D.C., to protest violence and racism against Asian Americans. Protests also took place in Montreal, Canada. The demonstrations come a few days after a white man in the metropolitan area of Atlanta killed 8 people, including 6 Asian women. Several American officials have also joined the rallies. U.S. Senate Majority Leader slammed hate crimes at the New York rally held in support of the country's Asian American community.
And I am urging, along with my colleagues, that our Justice Department prosecute fully and completely anybody who commits a hate crime against Asians or anybody else.
Schumer also noted that hate against one is hate against all, and such actions will not be tolerated. Meanwhile, U.S. Democratic Senator Tammy Duckworth has expressed doubts about the FBI director's initial assessment that the fatal shooting may not constitute hate crime. Duckworth demanded a deeper investigation into the incident, saying the killings look racially motivated. Earlier, U.S. President Joe Biden also denounced the rise in hate crimes and violence against Asian Americans in the country. And that's a wrap for now. Bye, everybody.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of a speech delivered on February 22, 2021 by Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, in a meeting with the chairman and members of the Assembly of Experts. The meeting was held at the end of the 8th session of the Assembly.
The more the Islamic government expands, the wider the scope of the Islamic government's activities becomes, the more arenas open to the Islamic Republic, and the more challenges it faces, challenges that did not used to exist in the past. As with the passage of time, there will be new challenges, arenas, and tasks for the Islamic government, the more it needs to update that software and that spiritual system. This is what I want to say.
این اون چیزیست که از فضلای صاحب نظر و متفکر به جد باید مطالبه بشه و این کار باید انجام بگیره.
This is what should be seriously demanded from intellectual and bright scholars, and this should be done. When we speak about updating the Islamic philosophy and about renewing and modernizing the Islamic ideological system, this does not mean tampering with that spiritual system in any way. Rather, it means that there are certain truths in the book and in the Sunnah to which we did not pay careful attention as long as we do not need them. Only when we begin to need them, we become aware of them. There are many examples in this regard, and I will cite a few ones here.
Your light and love, all I see, nothing more I'd ever want or need. My Lord, protect me from dishonor, grant me faith to be stronger.
For example, the Islamic government is faced with conditional pressures imposed by the enemy. By conditional pressures, I mean that they exert a pressure such as sanctions, and later on, they say that they will lift them provided that such and such a thing will be done. It is not the case that they thwart us completely. Rather, they say that they will lift them if such and such a thing is done. Well, this is a very dangerous and important issue. These conditions might be extremely misleading and lethal conditions. What should we do in such circumstances?
در یه چنین وضعی انسان چیکار باید بکنه؟ اینجا انسان متوجه میشه که فاستقم کما امرت و من تاب معک علاج اینه.
In such situations, we notice that the cure for this is to act on this ayah. Therefore, stand firm on the straight path as you are commanded. You and those who with you turn unto Allah.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah. All praises to Allah, all praises to
September 11, 2001, two hijacked airplanes were flown directly to the twin World Trade Center buildings in New York City. A few days later, U.S. Congress passed a resolution which has been used to justify Washington's military interventions abroad and detentions in Guantanamo Bay prison since. The authorization of the use of military force, or AUMF, granted the U.S. President the authority to use force against those who were involved in the 9/11 attacks. 2 years later, the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003 and opened a second major front in its so-called war on terror after invading Afghanistan. The invasion toppled Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein, but was followed by instability as well as deadly violence. According to the Kosovo War Project reports, since 2003, over 9.2 million Iraqis have been displaced across the country or have become refugees abroad. Washington is also responsible for around 300,000 deaths in Iraq between 2003 and 2009, a figure that could be much higher. Over two-thirds were civilians. In 2014, the country was overrun by the Daesh terror group that emerged amid the mayhem resulting from the U.S. invasion. That's while during the 2016 presidential campaigns, the former U.S. President Donald Trump said that Obama and Clinton are co-founders of the Daesh terrorist group. But Washington's acts did not end there. In 2020, four members of the U.S. private military firm Blackwater were pardoned. That is while Blackwater's mercenaries were prosecuted and found guilty of multiple criminal acts committed during a 2007 massacre at Nisr Square in Baghdad, which left 17 unarmed civilians dead and at least 20 wounded. The U.S.-led war in Iraq has had its negative impact on American people's lives as well. U.S. taxpayers have paid nearly $2 trillion in war-related costs on the Iraq War alone. That's an average of $8,000 per person and represents 9% of the national debt.
What the U.S. intended to do in Iraq is exactly what we see right now. The outcome that they were looking for is the destruction of the country, its continuous chaos in this country, in order for them to loot all the resources at the lowest cost.
A recent report published by the Cost of War Project says the U.S. military has conducted so-called counter-terror activities in over 85 countries in the past 3 years. The U.S. troops have also conducted bombing or ground attacks in 10 countries, including Afghanistan, Yemen, Syria, Iraq, Kenya, Libya, Mali, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Somalia over the same period. Moreover, Washington owns nearly 800 offshore military bases on all six continents. That is, while China is the biggest competitor of the U.S., has only one official overseas military base in Djibouti. The ongoing war on terror has taken a heavy toll, as over 15,000 U.S. troops and contractors, nearly 12,500 allied troops, 177,000 national military and police officers, 1,300 journalists and humanitarian aid workers, and over 335,000 civilians have lost their lives.
The war on terrorism is a war for terrorism, when in reality, the terrorism being created by the United States, the intended target is the destruction of the Arab and Muslim people.
After spending over $6.4 trillion and ruining lives of millions during the War on Terror campaign, Washington has failed to win a single war as of yet. With that, why does Washington fail to learn its lesson? The U.S. should correct the course now by repealing the 2002 AUMF.
The United States and China have held their first high-level in-person talk since President Joe Biden entered the Oval Office in Alaska on Thursday. The growing rift between the two nations was made evident before the media as diplomats traded barbs during the opening session, a formal function in diplomatic talks that's supposed to take minutes, which in this case lasted for an hour. U.S. State Secretary Antony Blinken said the issue of Hong Kong, Taiwan, cyber attacks on United States, blame on China, and what he called Beijing's economic coercion toward Washington's allies would be discussed during the two-day talks. In response, China's top diplomat Yang Jiechi slammed the U.S. for interfering in Beijing's internal affairs. The official also lashed out at Washington for what he called its struggling democracy and poor treatment of minorities. He also sharply criticized the U.S. foreign and trade policy. Blinken accused China of grandstanding during the public meeting, while his Chinese counterpart Wang Yi slammed the U.S. quote, inhospitality.
I think that the Chinese representatives were not expecting a friendly meeting, but I think we're surprised by the how intensely aggressive and hostile the statements were coming from the U.S. side. The Biden administration's attitude toward China and orientation toward China is even more hostile and belligerent and aggressive than was Trump. Every day there's something new.
Experts also believe the first major meeting between the two superpowers suggests that a reset of ties is not in the cards for the foreseeable future. During the bitter talks, the United States accused China of human rights violations. The Chinese foreign minister was quick to respond. He noted that the U.S. no longer has the qualification to speak to China from a position of strength, adding that many Americans have little confidence in the U.S. democracy.
In the United States, police kill over 1,100 people on the average year, and that's over the last 6 years. That's three a day. There's no other advanced capitalist country, developed capitalist country, that comes even close. Canada's the next one. And the U.S. rate is four times Canada's, but it's 27 times the rate in Germany and 67 times the rate of police killing in England and Wales. So those are very serious violations of human rights. There's great poverty in large sections of the U.S. and no prospects for getting better. That's a violation of human rights. So this very condescending attitude that the U.S. representatives are taking, and their idea that they can lecture others about human rights in the world, is I think much refuted by people all over the world, the governments and people all over the world today.
As part of his go-it-alone policy, former U.S. President Donald Trump provoked an all-out trade war with China, imposing several rounds of tariffs against billions of dollars worth of Chinese imports, a move that Beijing retaliated. The Trump administration also sanctioned several Chinese officials and major companies over a variety of different allegations, ranging from human rights violations to threatening the U.S. national security. During the 2020 U.S. presidential campaign, Trump's fellow Republicans feared that Joe Biden would adopt a soft stance in China. However, top Republicans have in recent weeks voiced approval of Biden's attempts to reset relations with Washington's allies and uniting them against China. Although the Biden administration is yet to clearly define its China policy, the opening of the first major meeting between the two sides served as a preview of what lies ahead for the two nations for at least the next 4 years.
Legal filings submitted by the British law firm quote speeches where the Syrian First Lady praises the mothers of Syrian soldiers killed on the front line. It also points to interviews where she supports her husband and soldiers for defending their homeland. The law firm says the evidence compiled, in our view, legally speaking, far exceeds what may be considered reasonable comment or mere propaganda and amount to the incitement, encouragement, and or aiding and abetting of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Again, analysts question why there has been no investigation for a single politician whose country has committed war crimes, such as leaders and officials in the U.S. or the U.K. and France.
The West takes it upon itself that they can attack and invade countries at will, and everything they do is justified, even if it's based on fabricated evidence, like the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq and, of course, the attack on Syria. This is... the United States, even under Obama, which was much better, was illegally invading countries. There was no justification, no resolution from the UN Security Council. And, it was pure hypocrisy that Syria represented a threat to the United States, or this is a defense of war.
The timing of this move raises further question marks. On Monday, the UK had imposed new sanctions on six Syrian government officials, including the country's foreign minister. Now that the fighting has subsided in Syria and government forces have the upper hand against terror groups, any military plots to overthrow the government appear to have failed. Could the West be looking at new ideas to destabilize the country? Syria faces fresh problems today, including the spread of the coronavirus and the state of its economy. American forces are occupying the country's east, where the oil reserves are, thereby preventing Damascus from using its oil revenue to rebuild vital infrastructure. The U.S. and Israel continue to launch airstrikes. Syria also accuses the European Union of being responsible for the suffering and bloodshed of civilians, saying the bloc, along with Britain, has backed terrorist groups. Yet, civilians are starting to return to many liberated parts of their homeland, including entire provinces that had been destroyed by various terror groups. Researchers say since March 2011, Washington has led a coalition of NATO countries, Arab monarchies, and Israel in a proxy regime change war using terrorist mercenaries as foot soldiers. Perhaps a wider investigation is needed to establish who supported the terrorists
who funded them, who backed them, who provided them with training, and who really committed war crimes in the Arab country. Britain's Metropolitan Police have opened a preliminary investigation into the wife of Syria's First Lady, Asma al-Assad. A London-based law firm has filed a complaint over allegations of incitement and encouragement to commit acts of terrorism. Asma has dual British Syrian nationality and could reportedly lose her British citizenship and have an international arrest warrant issued if convicted. The Metropolitan Police say it received a referral in July last year relating to the ongoing Syrian conflict. In a statement, the Met says the referral is in the process of being assessed by officers from the War Crimes Unit. British media suggests police are considering whether there is enough evidence to carry out a full investigation. This is why analysts say there is sufficient evidence to investigate former British Prime Minister Tony Blair for his leading role in the invasion of Iraq.
A total double standard. Actually, Tony Blair admitted that that George Bush was fabricating evidence against Syria. For the war, of course, you know, Blair has been invading a country. There's no legitimate reason for that. Plus, American troops are there at the present time, and British troops are actually even in Syria and French troops for a very long period of time, which does constitute a war crime.
As a result of the invasion of Iraq, hundreds of thousands of civilians have been killed. The invasion also led to the birth of terrorist groups that had no presence in the country before. These terrorists, including Al-Qaeda and Daesh, have killed and raped locals on a mass scale and ravaged the entire country. Yet the perpetrators of the invasion and its aftermath continue to live a lavish lifestyle. On the other hand, Asma al-Assad has suffered from cancer and has paid a considerable amount being treated for the disease, which raises questions over her role in the alleged crimes committed.
The COVID-19 pandemic has been negatively affecting minorities in the UK, especially the British Muslims. The coronavirus outbreak has caused hardships for a record number of Muslims in the country, with the faith group experiencing a fall into poverty at a much higher rate than the rest of the British population. Also, the demand for help among them has doubled within a year. According to the National Zakat Foundation and Islamic Relief UK, requests for financial help have risen from about 15 per day before the first lockdown measures were introduced in the country to over 70 per day toward the end of 2020. The National Zakat Foundation says it has offered £3.8 million in grants. The figure represented a 27% increase compared to the previous year. The charitable organization offers such grants from Zakat, the obligatory religious levy collected from British Muslims.
Day in, day out, Muslims are being attacked on media by politicians of all persuasion, you know, left, right, every aspect of their lives is being associated with terrorism, with negativity, and this has an impact. I mean, this will have impact both financially and psychologically on the Muslim community. Even Muslim organizations are not really adhered or supported.
With the second Ramadan and lockdown fest approaching, the national charity says funds are still urgently needed to respond to the continuing high demand for help. With the vast majority of Zakat typically given during Ramadan, the National Zakat Foundation is now urgently seeking funds to ensure they can meet the needs of the community in the weeks and months ahead. New figures from the Muslim Census Organization reveal the community has been falling into poverty at a rate 10 times higher than the UK population. The report also revealed that job losses among British Muslims have been 6 times greater compared to the rest of the population since the pandemic began. It also showed that 42% of Muslims surveyed had used their savings to cover their expenses during the pandemic. This is compared to a recent study by AJ Bell, an investment company, which recorded that 30% of UK people have had to use their savings. As well as facing poverty, Muslim communities are especially vulnerable to coronavirus, as many live in extended households where elderly people and those with existing health conditions are most at risk. Key workers such as NHS staff and transport workers from these families also have the additional fear of catching the virus. But there are other factors involved, including health inequalities.
Muslims, due to Islamophobia, and they have become second-class citizens in their own countries, in Britain, France, Germany, and most of the Western world. And they are being discriminated. They are the first one to be fired, they are the last one to be hired.
Experts believe the problem with the UK's health system is that people aren't getting the information and support they need.
It's not something that is just happening last week or last month. It's been going on for a very long time, and nothing is being done about it. Governments, not only they're not making an attempt to stop it, they are, them themselves and the politicians, are actually contributing to ever-increasing environment of hate against Muslims.
They say, as the pandemic comes to an end, the British government needs to reinvest in services that support people's health and ensure they're culturally and linguistically inclusive and accessible to people from all communities.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
Aklo Jawadi talks about the various keys of life and has brought about this book to be a companion for the very famous Mafatil Jiran, where one is a tool or the keys for paradise, and this book, of course, are the keys of life.
The Keys of Life, a program designed to tell you that what Islam gives you will help get you home with joy and faithfulness. So, well, listen to
The Keys of Life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. My name is Sheikh Zayd Al Salami. A few years ago, I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah al-Uzma al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Chapter 7 is an interesting topic, talking about clothes and the etiquette of dressing. The whole point about what it is that Islam says as far as the adab, the etiquette of clothing and dressing, is that Muslims should, number one, make sure that you are wearing clean clothes, that your clothes are clean, that the quality is good. You know, these are the 4 points that Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli says. He says, important point from based on summarizing these ahadith. Number one, nadafa, cleanliness. Number two, that you choose good quality clothes. Number three, that you stay simple, be simple. You know, you can choose a good quality piece of clothing that ranges in a reasonable price. Doesn't hit into the thousands, which is far from being reasonable. You know, I don't want to mention brands and things like that, or even currencies, you know, but we understand that this is something reasonable. That is not reasonable in any way. So that level of basata and that level of simplicity in life, or sada zist, as Sheikh Jawadi Amali says, is always important for us to remember, which is point number three. So cleanliness, good qualities, simplicity, and fourth is to avoid extravagance and wasting. Don't go after luxury. Oppose what it is that Ahlul Kitab wear. Now, of course, here there's an explanation that's given where Sheikh Jawadi mentions that, and at that time, Ahlul Kitab, they would wear something that resembles a boot that would be very, very long and these kind of things. Where, and Muslims, they should be showing themselves in that kind of sense where, you know, they are proud to have their heritage, their culture, their things like that. And they shouldn't be wearing clothes that resemble another identity. That's the important thing here. You know, nowadays, does wearing a pair of pants or a buttoned-up shirt resemble Ahlul Kitab? The answer is no. So some of these ahadith, or if you were to wear boots, for example, these days, does it resemble Ahlul Kitab? The answer is no. So we need to understand these ahadith within the correct context of Zaman and Makan as well. You know, that's an important point for us to always remember. You know, when it does come to certain things, is it appropriate for you to be wearing? You know, I always remember the, you know, famous kind of Arabic proverb, and my father used to always say this to me regularly. He says, eat that which you like, this Arabic proverb, eat that which you like and wear that which others approve of, or others like, others approve of, you know, because you're always going to be there out there in the public. You know, you don't want to be wearing certain things where you are going to put yourself in a situation where people will start talking bad about you, or maybe even backbiting you.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amali, the author of the book Mafatihul Hayat, The Keys of Life. This book, Mafatih, ought to be in two volumes. One volume, the present volume, Mafatihul Janan, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc. But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree. Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam, who has stressed out the reward for praying, has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
Hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, and this is also very, very interesting as well, you know, and that goes to the whole, all the details of these beautiful ahadith. He says, فَإِذَا نَزَعَ أَحَدُكُمْ ثَوْبَهُ فَلْيَطْوِهِ. If you take off your clothes, you should fold it. You know, when you're taking your piece of clothing off, don't just take it off. When you're taking it off, fold it as well. You know, be neat, be tidy. Okay, here, again, here it's talking about your shoes. What are you wearing on your feet? The hadith from Imam Ali alayhi salam, he says, وَلْيُجَوِّدَ الْحِذَاءَ وَلْيُخَفِّفَ الرِّدَاءَ. you should wear أجود الحذاء. You should wear a good quality piece, a pair of shoes. وليخفف الرداء. And wear something light when it comes to your shirt, when your clothes. Long hadith from Imam al-Rida, salamullahi alayh, where he says that when you are wearing your clothes, you should start wearing it from your right side. You know, it's the mustahab. Start wearing it from your right side. And when you are wearing something new, you should recite Inna anzalnahu fi laylatil qadr 10 times and Qul huwa Allahu ahad 10 times, Qul ya ayyuhal kafirun 10 times. And very interesting hadith that speaks about how we look at clothes as well, as far as appreciating what it is that a person wears. Now, what type of clothing or what color clothing should a person wear? We know that it is makruh to wear black, except if it is for hijab, except if it is for mourning, especially for mourning of Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam, and except if it is a aba'a, if it's a cloak, or except if it's a turban, a imama as well. Here Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alihi, he says, لَيْسَ مِنْ لِبَاسِكُمْ شَيْءٌ أَحْسَنُ مِنَ الْبَيَاضِ. There is nothing better as far as cloth color is concerned. There is nothing better than to wear white. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Wa salatu wa salamu ala Sayyidina Muhammad wa alihi tahirin.
Driving past, walking fast, to the field of dreams. Hear the children's screams.
There was The Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind. A momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time. Memories fade like a dusty window pane, and you can't see your past no more. The only thing that remains is that feeling of warmth in your heart that will always be there, be there.
Economic divide.
Hello and welcome to Economic Divide with me, Kaveh Tahwai. In this week's show, we will be looking at Russia and how the recent tensions with the EU have pushed Russia east towards China. The Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov said, "We're ready for that," in reference to Russia breaking ties with the EU. He even said, "If you want peace, prepare for war." The consequence for this type of approach, well, it risks the Russian economy to go downwards, including in the most sensitive areas. Since the annexation of Crimea in 2014, EU economic sanctions have targeted Russia's financial, defense, and energy sectors. Russia has responded with counter-sanctions, banning around half of its agri-food imports from the bloc. Well, EU leaders unanimously decided to extend the sanctions until the 31st of July 2021. The measures, which are renewed twice a year, have hit Russia hard. By late 2018, its economy was thought to be 6% lower in terms of its GDP output due to EU and US sanctions. Let's now look into our first report that studies the trade relation between the EU and Russia and how Russia does not need to look towards Europe for economic connectivity and new ideas.
Was a severe one. Russia warned the EU that it would cut ties over economic sanctions. Russia accused the EU that three of its diplomats had attended an illegal pro-Navalny protest. Russia's opposition leader, Alexei Navalny, has been a vocal critic of the Russian President Vladimir Putin, and the EU has slammed Russia for jailing him.
And for the first time, last week on Monday, we decided to implement sanctions because of the Navalny case. It means that we are totally committed and we are united in Europe in order to be very tough, very firm, in order to promote our values, to defend our interests.
Well, obviously, this represents a very serious escalation in tensions between Russia and the European Union. And the backdrop to all of this is, of course, the pandemic and the massive economic and social and political strain that's putting both on Russia and upon the European Union. Now, of course, EU leaders say that this is about Navalny in Russia and the crackdown on democratic dissent and so on. I think most people can see that this is hypocritical.
Russia-EU trade relations will surely deteriorate even further now that both will trade sanctions. But how low can this relationship go? The European Union and Russia have an important bilateral trade relation. Russia is the EU's fifth largest trading partner, and the EU is Russia's largest trading partner. The trade value between the two is valued at 232 billion euros for the year 2019. In 2019, Russia was the origin of 40% of EU imports of gas and 27% of EU imports of oil. Due to the large value of these imports, the EU's trade deficit with Russia is only second to EU's trade deficit with China. Taking a look at imports and exports, the main EU exports to Russia are in the categories of machinery, transport equipment, medicines, chemicals, and other manufactured products. Meanwhile, the main EU imports from Russia are raw materials, especially oil, like crude and refined gas, as well as metals, notably iron, steel, aluminum, and nickel.
Joining me in the studio is current affairs and impact analyst Mahan Abedin. We also have Mark Sloboda, a Moscow-based international affairs and security analyst. He provides security and geopolitical analysis to various media outlets, and as a political risk consultant, he also operates in that capacity. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Mark Sloboda, first to you. Russia heading for a break is what the news says with the EU. The Russian foreign minister, his quote, "We're ready for that. If you want peace, prepare for war." He said that a break in ties could be triggered by EU sanctions, and that will create risk for the Russian economy, including in the most sensitive areas. What does this mean when it comes to the economies of both Russia and the EU, and the impact of this break were it to occur?
Okay, so Lavrov's comments about the potential for a break with the EU come in the context of the EU discussing new sanctions, yet another sanctions package to level against Russia over the affair with the fringe far-right Russian ultranationalist Alexei Navalny, who is pretty much openly supported by Western media and intelligence services. Russia draws a severe difference between the EU and the individual member states of the EU in Europe.
Okay, it sounds an awful lot like what Trump used to say about the EU and the individual countries. Well, Mahan, relations between the EU and Russia are at a low, another low. And you have sanctions that have been exercised, the case of Navalny basically being the push there. It seems there's no escaping it, that the sanctions is bringing Russia to a point where it needs to decide how it's going to still be bound to the sphere of the EU in terms of trade, for example. Does the EU, given how badly it's in need of an economic boost with the way that it's suffering from the COVID-19 cumulatively, can it afford to actually lose a trading partner like Russia?
Well, in short, no, because the EU is undergoing tremendous problems. I mean, Brexit is one of them, the UK leaving. The UK was a huge part of the EU, especially from a defense and security point of view. It was really the only country that had weight and punch on the international stage, France excepting, perhaps. So there's the UK issue, there's schisms and its own centrifugal forces. Look, this vaccination rollout is a prime example of how the EU cannot cope with a major crisis.
Thank you for that. Now we're going to take a look at the next report that's coming up, which in this case is going to focus on the way that